And good morning. And welcome to Word of Mouth. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today my guest is Beatles scholar Aaron Ketovich. Aaron earned a BA in music theory and composition from Butler University in 2008, a master's in music composition from Boston University, and a graduate artist diploma in music composition from the University of Hartford. While still a student, he won a research grant to study the Beatles and has presented his findings through lectures at universities and libraries throughout the East Coast and Midwest. One of only two Beatles scholars in the world, Aaron is the author of The Beatles and the Avant-Garde, a fascinating study of how the Fab Four used innovative thinking and techniques to become the greatest cult phenomenon of the last 50 years. And Aaron, thanks for returning to Word of Mouth. Welcome back. Great to see you again.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
So you're one of only two professional Beatles scholars in the world.
That's correct.
Wow. What's it mean to be a Beatles scholar? And who's the other guy?
Sure, yeah. The other guy is Mark Lewisohn, and I can't call him the other guy because he is the world's authority on the band, and for good reason. So to my knowledge, only he and I make our livings as Beatles scholars. So he's an author. He's just come out with his book, Tune In, which is a three-part Beatles biography, and he just came out with the first volume. I guess it was more than a year ago now, but it's still relatively new, and it's hugely popular and the definitive biography of the band. So what I do, I've done a couple of books as well, but most of what I do is presentations, educational presentations, like at libraries and community centers. So I did one last night up in Franklin, Wisconsin on the Beatles prior to Beatlemania, and then I've got a whole bunch of them coming up as well.
And we'll talk about that as we continue our discussion. Mm-hmm. And actually, I want to talk a little bit about your book, The Beatles and the Avant-Garde.
Sure.
By the way, wonderful cover on that book, too.
Oh, thank
just
you.
Terrific. Was recently published.
Mm-hmm.
And,
last year.
Yeah. In fact, the last time you were here, we touched on the subject briefly about the avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
And let's kind of clarify again, if we can. I don't know. It's a pretty broad term.
Yes.
But what is the avant-garde movement?
Yep.
Or maybe what was it?
Yep.
And how did it influence the Beatles?
Sure. Yeah, that's a question I often get is you know, what does avant-garde mean? Like everyone knows the Beatles, but what is the avant-garde?
You sound cool when you say avant-garde too.
Well, yeah, French term. Yeah, it always sounds suave. So avant-garde essentially means advance guard. It's a French term meaning advance guard, and it's typically used to mean cutting edge or new and innovative. And the real peak of the avant-garde, artistic movement was the mid 20th century, when guys like Marcel Duchamp is known for helping create this kind of innovative atmosphere in the artistic world. He was a little bit before and then the avant-garde movement kind of builds off what Duchamp and others like him were doing. In the mid-20th century. And so the influence on the Beatles then, specifically musically, there are many avant-garde composers of like the 1950s and 1960s that were influential on John, Paul, George, and Ringo. So guys like American John Cage is an avant-garde master. Who else? Luciano Berio is an Italian avant-garde composer who was influential more on Paul than on John. Karlheinz Stockhausen is a German avant-garde composer. Cornelius Cardew is a British avant-garde composer. So all of these guys influenced the Beatles.
Who would have thought all that came into I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Yeah, well, it was after
I know,
that.
I know. I'm just teasing. Okay.
I do have a little bit that I'll read just a paragraph or two from the introduction to help kind of put this in context. So avant-garde meaning kind of new and cutting edge. But oftentimes that makes for challenging music to listen to because it's so, it's so unusual and kind of out there. And so oftentimes it can estrange your listeners when you start using these kind of techniques. Hmm. So quoting the paragraph from the introduction, Given the mania of Beatlemania and the popular mythical status of all four band members, estranging their patrons was not only okay with the Beatles, but to a certain extent desirable. It would break the cultural and musical expectations of them that formed in their early 60s heartthrob period. Moreover, in the avant-garde, they found a set of techniques and ideas that expanded their musical vocabulary as well as their ambitions, which helped take them from being a great rock band to being a once-in-a-lifetime cultural force. So it's how they grow up from being a I don't want to say simple, but simpler, perhaps, pop group into being the foremost artists of their generation.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty.
Okay.
Like into the recording studio.
Yeah.
Okay, the behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. What were some of the new techniques that you mentioned in your paragraph there?
Mm-hmm.
New ways, new methods that the Beatles employed in writing and recording their music that maybe other groups weren't doing,
mm-hmm.
And maybe even some specific examples like Beatles songs where they, you know, they were doing this kind of new innovative technique that other people weren't doing.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
The first song that comes to mind is "I Am the Walrus" by by John Lennon's classic.
And that
song
was weird when you first heard it. No doubt about it.
It's still weird.
It's still avant-garde.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
So then, you know, John writes this song, and they get to the end of the tune, and they think, you know, we need something more to tack on at the end, something like the little cherry on top. And he borrowed an idea from John Cage, and I don't know how conscious he was of this, but John Cage wrote a piece in 1950, maybe six or ish,
mm-hmm.
Called "Imaginary Landscape Number 4," and it's written for 13 radios. And each radio has a set of instructions saying, you know, from 1 minute and 13 seconds into the piece to 3 minutes and 12 seconds into the piece, this radio goes to, you know, a station, you know, 10:50 a.m. or whatever it is. And
mm-hmm.
whatever is being broadcast on that station at that time goes into that particular performance of the piece. So there's no control. You know, Cage is giving up control of his product, but he's kind of setting up a scenario in which whatever happens to be broadcast is goes into that performance of the piece. So then there's 13 radios. Multiply that by 13 different radios, and you can never, ever come up with the same performance of that piece twice, because everything that's going to be broadcast on any given time is going to be very different.
Interesting.
So it's a degree of random, you know, chance elements. Cage is known for aleatory is the technical term. It just means chance elements, you know, setting up random. You define the parameters, but then what happens within those parameters is left to chance. So what Lennon did then is take the same idea and tack it on to the end of "I Am the Walrus."
Mm-hmm.
So he's, as the code is fading out, he goes and he twiddles the dial on his radio, and what does he find? He finds a version of William Shakespeare's King Lear, and they just tack that on in a couple of different spots, but most notably at the end. So it's an example of the Beatles taking an avant-garde technique that was really invented by John Cage, or at least I don't know if he invented it, but popularized, and he's the figurehead of that kind of chance element aspect. And it's an example of the Beatles taking that and incorporating it into their own pop music sensibilities.
Oh, it's just great. I mean, they really were diving into the deep end with all this stuff.
Yes, and especially Lennon.
And I guess, they really didn't. It's almost like, if this gets accepted, fine. If it doesn't, that's fine too, because it does take a little effort to listen to "I Am the Walrus," particularly the end of it.
Yeah, it's trippy, but it's fantastic in every sense of the word.
So any other songs, too, I mean, that they were doing in the studio
sure.
that you recall where they were kind of doing these kind of neat things
mm-hmm.
like that?
Well, "I Am the Walrus" is primarily a Lennon song. It's credited Lennon-McCartney, mm-hmm. but it's mostly a Lennon song.
And we're going to get into that later, too. I want
okay.
the whole Lennon-McCartney thing. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So for a Paul example, is the perhaps the most famous example is "A Day in the Life."
Mm-hmm.
And that one genuinely is a collaboration. They co-wrote that one. But nonetheless, the
See, I thought that was John Lennon too.
Well
go
the,
ahead.
The verses,
you're the expert. What am
yeah,
I doing?
The
okay.
verses are Lennon.
Okay.
"I read the news today, oh boy,"
mm-hmm.
that's all Lennon. And
mm-hmm.
then the middle part, "woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across
okay.
my head." That's
mm-hmm.
Paul's section.
Okay.
But then of course they have to connect the two. They've got the John's verses, they have Paul's bridge. Well, how do we get from one to the next? And Paul came up with the idea of the orchestral sound mass, which is have a full symphony orchestra and have them play, you know, start really low in their range, and little by little they get higher and higher and louder until it's, you know, apocalyptic in its impact. And that's what connects, you know, John's verses, the verse 3 to Paul's bridge, and then that's reprised, of course, at the end of the song, right before you get the massive piano chord that actually concludes the track.
And you know, when that's going on, that orchestral thing you're talking about, I felt like what Alice must have felt like going down the rabbit hole. It's just it's kind of like you're getting turned around.
You don't know which direction's up.
And you're kind of uncomfortable when you're first listening to it, the very first experience. And, one of my favorite Beatles songs, though, that's always hard.
It's classic.
It's just great. I'm having a little fun here, Aaron. Can I pick your brain a little bit more?
Go for it.
Any other songs that come to mind? I Am the Walrus, A Day in the Life, any others you can think of your head?
Let me ask you, do you have a particular song in mind that you're wondering about?
Well, we're going to play The End later on
at
the end of the program. I love that from Abbey Road. But I don't know if people are familiar with that one. So maybe off the top of their head. So maybe we ought to go with, In Your Life. I don't know if there's anything that they did with that was innovative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of my favorite songs. There are places I've been to.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry. I'm not going to sing, Aaron.
Okay.
You're getting nervous there.
So quickly on The End, I don't talk about The End much in the book, The Beatles and the Avant-Garde. It doesn't have anything particularly.
Plus, that's kind of more of an obscure song on Abbey Road. Once you hear it, it's very familiar.
Yes.
But if I say The End, a lot of people might think, oh, The Doors, The End. Or, you know what I mean? So whatever. Anyway, go ahead.
We were talking about the Shakespeare element in I'm the Walrus. And Shakespeare often ends his plays with a little rhyming couplet.
A little couplet,
And the Beatles do the same thing on Abbey Road with The End. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. It's got that kind of Shakespeare rhythm. It's not perfect iambic pentameter, but it's close. So there's another Shakespeare kind of reference that Paul McCartney throws in at the very end of what would be the last recorded album. But then getting to In My Life, which is a couple years earlier, 65, that's on Rubber Soul, at least the UK version. I'm not as familiar with the American versions because they split them up and made as many different records as they could so they could make more money. But
that's okay. We'll let that pass.
Right. Yeah. So the famous piano solo in that case is an example of their innovative recording techniques because it sounds quite like a harpsichord, which is a keyboard instrument that was around when Bach was playing. The piano, as we know it today, hadn't been invented when Bach was writing his keyboard work. He didn't like organ and stuff. So they wanted that kind of nostalgic, retrospective sound that you would get with a harpsichord, but they didn't want to actually use a harpsichord because I don't even know if they even had a harpsichord to use. But what they did was they used a piano and played it and recorded it an octave lower and half as fast as we hear it on the finished product. Then when they played the tape back, instead of playing it at normal speed, they play it at double speed, which had the effect of doubling the tempo and raising the pitch by one octave. And in doing so, they yield a product that imitates a harpsichord sound, a very dry and fast decay on the instrument that we hear in the finished product of In My Life.
Incredibly innovative.
Yeah.
Were there other groups doing any of this? I mean, were the Beatles pretty much the ones at the time that were kind of experimenting with the avant-garde? Or were the Rolling Stones, for example, involved in any of that as well?
Stones less so. I don't know the Stones nearly as well as I know the Beatles.
But they
were doing their own things, which were different from what the Beatles were, they're both English rock bands playing at the same time.
But we are here to talk about the Beatles. I'm going to take you down a road of the Rolling Stones. We don't need to do that. Let's get back to the recording process. One last thing, or there may be more things later. George Martin.
Mm-hmm.
He gets credit, but really not so much credit. So for the record, what was his involvement, his influence on the writing, the recording of particular songs and the whole process when they were in the recording studio? He wasn't merely just a producer, but he was more involved than that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a perfect segue because the idea for the wound-up piano, as it's called, was George Martin's to play it an octave lower and speed it up.
Mm.
He had done that many times before, before he ever met the Beatles. He had used that technique, and it had been used in other contexts as well, like Alvin and the Chipmunks, their voices, their high, squeaky voices. The way they did that was by using that playback at double speed, and that gives you that squeaky voice. So that's what George Martin was able to bring. He had a lot of experience before even meeting the Beatles in innovative and experimental recording techniques. So then when the Beatles come in and constantly tell him, we don't want it to sound like our last record. We want it to sound different. Find a way to make the same ideas sound completely different. So he was
so
able
it was
to
a collaboration
draw
of the three of them.
Very much a collaboration, yeah.
Okay, so they would write the music, and then Martin would come up with some of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he would have help. Jeff Emmerich wrote a book a few years ago called Here, There, and Everywhere about his about the experimental recording techniques. And I quote that a lot in my own book because he's firsthand. He's a primary source. He was there, and he was actually helping George Martin and the Beatles come up with these really innovative solutions as ways to push the limits of what was possible in the studio.
So any other particular songs with George Martin where he definitely, you could say, that was George Martin? Am I putting you on the spot here?
Well, In My Life is probably the most obvious choice.
Okay.
I can flip through and...
No, that's okay. That's okay. Okay, songwriting teams. Let's get back to Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah, yeah.
We have Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Oh, yeah.
Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Elton John and Bernie Taupin. I can go on. Lerner and Lowe. Okay, let's face it. Lennon and McCartney are the most famous, the most successful team of all time.
Mm-hmm.
How did these two very different personalities manage to write together? And I know they would write apart sometimes and then come together, but what was the process or procedure when Lennon and McCartney would team up together, these two unique people?
Yeah, very different.
We always
people.
Think of John Lennon being dark or half
in
empty
general.
And Paul, you know, the glass is half full. But it's bigger than that. But what would it be like when they're sitting down like the two of us are sitting down and now, hey, we're going to write a song. What was that process like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the early years, it was genuine collaboration. So songs like She Loves You or I Want to Hold Your Hand are you know, to say they're 50-50 equally between Lennon, equally responsible for the song would be accurate. As they matured,
50-50.
Yeah,
okay.
In the early years.
Okay.
As they matured and developed their own individual identities as songwriters, they tended to veer off in their own direction. So that's where we get John with his witty wordplay and lyrics and kind of dark, pessimistic character. And then you get Paul with his brighter, happier, more optimistic, like Penny Lane. And to a certain extent, stereotypes, it's a stereotype, but at the same time, there's a reason it's a stereotype. There's a reason why that's the cliche way of describing them is because there's a degree of truth to it. Not entirely, because of course John wrote the Lullaby for Julie and Goodnight that closes the White Album, which is about as soft as anything the Beatles ever did, and lush and romantic, as opposed to the more biting tunes like Glass Onion, for example. So anyway. As they matured, they kind of separated a little bit and went their own different ways. But at the same time, even though they were writing more independently, they would always bring the songs that they were working on to the other for polishing. And so Paul would kind of polish Lennon's stuff, and he would make it a little more commercial, maybe commercially viable. And Ed telling him maybe speed this up a little bit, or well, please me is actually maybe a good example there. Because originally it was a slow shuffle, like Roy Orbison style. Mm-hmm. And at some point they say, you know what, this works so much better if we speed it up and make it a little more energetic. Revolution is another one.
Well, Please Me was kind of a Everly Brothers influence too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So back in the USSR, they collaborated on that, did they? Or was that basically?
That's more Paul.
That was more Paul?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not
right.
so much John, especially
But John
the
wanted
album.
To slow it down, didn't he? Or was there I read something about that.
Maybe. I don't recall offhand.
Right.
But
yeah.
Especially the White Album tends to be much more individualistic than really any of the other albums. So it's still a group performance, but the actual songs themselves and the composition, the compositional aspects of them tend to be more individualized than on any other Beatles album.
You know, I know you weren't there, but perhaps you read about it. And this maybe if I'm driving this into the wall, let me know. But I'm just curious, let's say the early years, when they would sit down and collaborate, what record do we have of what they would do when they would collaborate? I mean, who would one be at the guitar and the other one would be just throwing out lyrics? Or was it kind of just a back and forth type of thing like that? Yeah, where did they get their inspiration, I guess, is what I'm trying to come up with.
My understanding is they would work mostly on guitar. I've read quotes from Paul and John saying they would work nose to nose. They'll play a chord and throw out some lyrics, and the other will take that and tweak it a little bit, and then it'll go back to the other, to the original. And he'll further tweak it. So that's what I mean by genuine collaboration. Is this back and forth? It's like it's like tennis. You hit it to me, I hit it back to you,
okay.
You hit it to me, and that's
Great
what they
memory.
Would do with their guitars. you know, just sitting in the living room or in a hotel room or wherever they happen to be, on the bus, the tour bus maybe.
So 8 days a week, was that Ringo's thing where he just yelled that out in the back of the car and then they both went during the Beatlemania process?
Yeah, I've heard a couple of different stories. One is that Ringo, you know, Ringo would often come up with these, you know, malapropisms like A Hard Day's Night. So that could come, it could come from Ringo. The other story I've heard is that Paul was in a taxi on his way over to John's house trying to write a song and he was talking, just making small talk with the driver. And, you know, said, "How are you doing? What you up to?" And he said, "You know, working 8 days a week." I mean, and so who knows what the actual story is, but
right. So while Lennon and McCartney wrote songs individually,
yeah,
what was kind of cool was that they co-credited, mm-hmm. co-authored, co-owned mm-hmm. each other's songs.
Right.
So for example, if Paul McCartney I think wrote Yesterday,
yep.
and John Lennon said I Don't Believe in Yesterday, I think that's a famous quote.
Yeah.
Yet they had this spirit of copyright, co-copyright. How'd that all come about?
The copyright part?
Well, I guess, I don't want to get into the whole Apple thing, but I guess in terms of co-crediting each other and, you know, what's yours is mine.
Right.
What's mine is yours.
Mm-hmm. And in the early years, because it was genuine collaboration, that's when they decided to share songwriting credits for everything.
Mm-hmm. But on Yesterday, you'll see Lennon and McCartney, for example, which
right.
was Paul's song.
Even though it's Paul's song, Lennon's not heard on it. You know, he doesn't sing, he doesn't play any of the instruments. It's all Paul plus the string quartet that they mm-hmm. that they overdubbed. So even though Lennon really had nothing at all to do with it, he's credited. They decided early on when everything they wrote was a genuine collaboration, they decided early on to share everything, songwriting credits on everything. So any song written by John or Paul would be credited equally, Lennon McCartney. So if they had started by writing tunes like Yesterday or Strawberry Fields, which are clearly one or the other, they might not have agreed to do that collaboration. But because all of the early stuff did represent genuine cooperation and collaboration, they were fine saying everything we write will be credited equally.
Which is just, pretty harmonizing.
Literally and figuratively.
In terms of when they made that moment where you saw that we're going back now to the avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
is there a particular point where you saw that where that innovative cutting edge where they kind of left the yeah part mm-hmm. behind them and began to then move into this more, for sake of another word, modern
More,
cutting edge?
More artistic.
Yeah, more artistic. What point did that occur?
Sure. Well, it's a gradual process, and certainly Yesterday fits in there in my life. It contributes to that change. The tune Help comes to mind because the opening lyrics are, "When I was young, so much younger than today," which is a stark contrast to the early stuff like A Hard Day's Night or She Loves You, yeah, which is all about a celebration of youth and adolescence. So by the time you get to Help, even though it's only 1 year after A Hard Day's Night, you get lyrics that are deliberately trying to put that youthfulness of the early stuff behind them. You know, when I was young, so much younger than today, implying that I'm no longer young. I'm much more mature now, mm-hmm. even though it's only 1 year later.
So you would say that was the turning point.
Well,
it's a gradual process.
But that's one of that's a clear landmark in there. In their thoughts of how they perceived themselves and their own music. You know, they're no longer trying to go for the bubblegum pop song, not to diss the early stuff, because I think that's fantastic too, but it is a little bit shallow in terms of depth. And then around 64, late 64 and 65, you get much more personal music from John Lennon, where he sings about his own problems. You know, "Help me if you can, I'm feeling down." You know, he has problems and he needs help. And that's a pretty strong contrast in character from She Loves You, yeah.
Well, it's very interesting. My guest today is Beatles scholar Aaron Ketovich, author of The Beatles and the Avant-Garde. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. We'll continue our discussion about The Beatles after these messages. Don't go away. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. My guest today is Beatles scholar Aaron Ketovich, author of The Beatles and the Avant-Garde. And in the background, you just heard Here Comes the Sun from the Beatles' Abbey Road album. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking about a number of things, primarily Lennon and McCartney in the studio and the Avant-Garde. And I want to get back to the Avant-Garde in just a second, and maybe this is part of a segue, too, anyway, because I want to talk about Yoko Ono. But we just heard George Harrison on, mm-hmm. on Abbey Road, and he gets kind of lost in the shuffle a lot of times. Often. When you're talking about Lennon, McCartney, and we focus so much on in the first segment on them.
Yeah.
And I guess I want to know what was George's contribution to the group, and at what point did you start to see maybe him moving into that avant-garde mm-hmm. Movement, and where he had a voice as well.
Yeah, yeah. He was often kind of treated as an annoying younger brother by John and Paul because they were a couple of years older than he was, and they're still friends. You know, it was always it was always friendly, but at the same time, he was the young kid who always got picked on. So he's kind of overshadowed. But towards the end, he does come into his own as a songwriter, and so certainly what you were playing, "Here Comes the Sun," represents a significant step forward in George Harrison's maturation as a songwriter. He also explores the avant-garde a little bit, much less so than Paul or John did. But he actually put out an album of avant-garde music called Electronic Sound in 1969, I believe it was. And it was all using synthesizers. The Moog synthesizer had just come out. And so that was like the new toy. And so he would go through and he would fiddle with all the bells and whistles on the synthesizer. And he ended up coming up with an album's worth of material, none of which is it could be described as a pop song. But it's really interesting to hear a pop musician who's deliberately branching out into these more experimental and exploratory style of music.
Do you think "Here Comes the Sun" was sort of the beginning of that, or was it with or without you? In terms of the avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
or do you really feel it was the synthesizer thing? For me to say,
yeah, it's a little bit of both, because mm-hmm. certainly the Indian influence that George Harrison is famous for. Contributes to that kind of exotic flavor. I mean, in this case, it's more, kind of an ethnomusicological thing, like exploring other cultures and their instruments and things like that. Whereas the avant-garde is much more of a Western genre, exploratory genre. But nonetheless, it fits in with the general idea of, try it and see what happens. You know, let's try these unusual things. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So it does kind of, he was kind of headed there in a sense anyway before he did that avant-garde album, Electronic Sound. But then something like Here Comes the Sun, it represents a move away from that, because at some point the Beatles try to return to their roots. And that's what Get Back is all about. The album Let It Be was originally titled Get Back. And the idea was for the band to get back to how they played, mm-hmm. Like a decade prior, before they became very sophisticated in the recording studio, before psychedelia, before Beatlemania, before all of that. And Here Comes the Sun fits into that, even though it's not on the album Let It Be. It fits into that style because it shows Harrison kind of going back to his roots. He's just writing a simple pop song, having done the more crazy stuff like the Electronic Sounds album. He decides, this really isn't for me. I just want to go back to my roots. I want to write just a simple, happy pop song. And he came up with Here Comes the Sun.
Yoko Ono.
Oh yes.
Okay. Interesting. Polarizing.
Very polarizing.
Yeah. So when we say avant-garde, she comes to mind. So tell me about Yoko.
Yeah, the four Beatles were pop musicians who took what they could from avant-garde art and incorporated it into their own popular music. Yoko, on the other hand, essentially grew up as an avant-garde artist. So long before she ever met John Lennon, she was associated with the New York avant-garde scene. And guys like George McCunis, who's sometimes known as the father of the New York avant-garde. So she had a strong background from that, and she was able to bring that to the Beatles. So when you talk about the Beatles and the avant-garde, she's perhaps the single biggest influence in that sense on the Beatles, and particularly on John Lennon. And what I found, having done all sorts of Beatles programs across the nation, is that not very many people understand what Yoko was trying to do when she does all of her, you know, crazy performance pieces, like sitting in a bag on stage during performances, like the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. John and Yoko performed. So John goes up there and plays his guitar. Yoko just gets in a bag and sits on stage and doesn't move. And it's pretty bizarre. And what I've found is that not very many people have an understanding of why John Lennon liked her in the first place.
Yes.
What did he see in her?
Yes.
Why was he interested? You know, no one else seemed to care. So why did John Lennon care? And that was one of the fundamental motivations behind this book, is trying to look at Yoko and try and figure out what she's trying to do as a way to explain what she's doing and why she was appealing to John Lennon. So that the book attempts to put her life in and art into the Beatles' context to help explain what was happening and why Lennon was so infatuated with her.
So I need some specifics here, because as far as I'm concerned, she's got. It seems like you're kind of the therapist saying Yoko was misunderstood. And the rest of us are back here going, yeah, she had a bag over her head. So
yes.
What, help me here.
So I'm trying to think of a good example that I can.
Well, the bad end, I guess, was
that
had some real meat behind it.
Yeah, and we talked earlier about how...
Maybe we should mention what the bed-in was.
The bed-in for peace.
Yeah.
They did two of them, one in Amsterdam and one in...
Canada, wasn't it?
Canada. I forget if it was Montreal or Toronto. I think it was Montreal. Yeah. I forget offhand. But
Two
of them, and the idea was, no matter what they did for their honeymoon, John Lennon's honeymoon was going to be hugely publicized. You know, the media was going to cover it, whether they wanted them to or not. So at some point they say, well, why don't we use that? Instead of that being a bad thing, we can't get away from the media. Why don't we find a way to use the media to propagate political messages that we believe in? So in this case, peace. You know, so they hold their bed-ins for peace, and in that sense, the media that came and covered the bed-ins were the method of transmission, the medium by which they were able to spread their political ideals.
Right, right, right.
And that ties in.
And they drew other celebrities too. I think Tommy Smothers was there and some others.
Yeah, I think he was at the Canadian one.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so was Yoko behind that whole bed-in thing? Was
was
her avant-garde thing? She took the bag off her head? I'm sorry. I don't mean to make pot shots at her.
It's very easy to do so. But you can't just dismiss
can't deny her
as completely insane or out there. There are reasons why she's doing the things that she does, and that's what I go into.
Were saying, what did John Lennon see in Yoko?
Yes.
Okay, so.
And one of the things, so the bed-ins fulfill this is, Yoko loved what she called unfinished art, meaning she sets up, well, much like John Cage. We talked earlier about John Cage and how he'll set up parameters, but then it's what happens on any given performance of that piece depends on random chance, whatever these radio stations happen to be broadcasting at that time. So similarly, Yoko loves what she calls unfinished art, in which somehow the viewer or the audience has to complete the work. So she'll set up a scenario, and then the viewer has to execute on that. So in the case of the bed-ins, John and Lennon collaborate, and they set up a scenario where they're in bed together with their signs up on the walls that promote peace and whatnot. And it's up to the media who's covering the event to fulfill it finish essentially the work by propagating their messages to the world.
Interesting. Okay, so she's kind of the beginning of whatever idea or concept there is, and then people kind of fill in the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a pretty simple
That was pretty simple, yeah.
Abbey Road, we just heard from it, and read in a blog that's your favorite album.
It is indeed.
And why? I like it too, by the way, instead of millions of others.
Mm-hmm.
But why Abbey Road?
Yeah, the in terms of cultural influence, you'd have to go with Sgt. Pepper being the Beatles' peak.
You'd think, yeah.
But in terms of specifically musical influence or sophistication, musical sophistication, no Beatles album can compare with Abbey Road. The White Album comes close. Some of the stuff on the White Album is really sophisticated stuff. But nothing the Beatles did can compare with Abbey Road. The medley on side B is just phenomenal. The way that it's set up and structured. And it's also tough to come up with, you know, what is it, 15 minutes worth of music, you know, nonstop music, without kind of getting, I don't want to say boring or monotonous, but it's very easy with something of that scope to become, routine's not the right word either, but you kind of know what to expect after a while. And with the medley, because it's so, you know, all these little fragments that are stuck together and it's constantly changing, I find it very engaging for that reason. To get a little more esoteric, when you look at how the song is structured tonally, is also very significant and sophisticated, because most pop songs are in one key for the whole song. Because if it's just 3 minutes long, that, you know, that's fine. But if you have a 15-minute song that's in one key, you develop what's known as pitch fatigue. You just get tired of hearing the same notes and the same chords for 15 minutes straight. So what the Beatles do to vary that is set up a tonal design that goes back and forth between A and C. So it starts in A minor with "You Never Give Me Your Money." And then in the middle section of that song, it goes into C major. "Out of college, money sent, money spent, see no future, pay no rent." That part's in C major. And then at the end of that opening track, "You Never Give Me Your Money," the opening track of the medley, it goes back to A, but now instead of A minor, it's in A major. And then you get the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, "All good children go to heaven." And what Paul does in that specific track, the opening track of the medley, is kind of a microcosm. It showcases and foreshadows what happens throughout the rest of the medley, and it goes back and forth between A major and C major throughout the rest of the piece. So the way it's put together and structured is extremely sophisticated and quite compelling.
Do you have a particular song or piece on Abbey Road that would be your favorite?
It's tough to locate just one.
It is. It is. But AM Top 40 radio stations were able to break it up.
Medley up?
Yeah, and play little pieces. But,
I've never heard
so,
of that.
But how about on the A side then? Is there anything there that...
They're all pretty awesome.
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Here Comes the Sun that we were playing earlier has always been one of my favorites.
Okay.
Part of the reason I like that so much is the tonal structure of the medley is that is something that I find quite compelling about that. The rhythmic structure of "Here Comes the Sun" is also quite sophisticated. And I don't know, can we play just the middle section of "Here Comes the Sun"? Can we do that, or do we have to play
right this moment? I can't.
Yeah, okay.
But we will hear the end in just a moment.
Okay, so in that case, the middle section of "Here Comes the Sun," where they sing "Sun, Sun, Sun,
right,
here
right,
it
right.
comes," has constantly changing rhythms. And it, rather than just a four in the bar, you know, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, like most many pop songs are just in 1 meter throughout. But "Here Comes the Sun" is constantly changing, and for that reason is very rhythmically sophisticated. In fact, my wife worked at Middlesex Music Academy in Middletown, Connecticut. She's worked there for about 5 years. And for a while, the piano studio where she taught was next door to the drum studio. And so occasionally when I would go and pick her up from work, I would hear these, you know, drum students, these little like 7-year-old drummers, trying to play "Here Comes the Sun."
How about that?
Problem is, it's really hard because it's really rhythmically sophisticated. And so whenever I would go and pick her up, I would just hear these, you know, 5-year-old drummers just massacring "Here Comes the Sun."
Sure, sure.
The reason is because it's hard. It's really sophisticated. So there's an example. Yeah, the medley is tonally sophisticated, the way these two different tonalities are juxtaposed over the course of those, you know, 12, 15 minutes, whatever it is. And then we have "Here Comes the Sun" on the other side, which is very rhythmically sophisticated.
Okay. Overall, looking at all the wealth of material, all the songs that the Beatles have done.
Yeah, 211 of them.
Wow. And I'm not going to talk esoterically here.
Okay.
Because I can't. Okay. But emotionally,
yeah,
gut level,
yep.
I haven't heard that from you yet about the Beatles.
Yeah,
and this is your second visit here.
Mm-hmm.
Getting away from the scholarly, Aaron, what emotionally, when you hear that song, and that's how many of us folks react to music, is there a song, a couple particular songs where you just are, you know, in the heart, in your gut, you feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we've talked about the two that come to mind already in the medley and "I Am the Walrus."
Okay, so you did feel that. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I definitely tend more towards the intellectual than the emotional side, just in general, not just with music.
Like
just
Dr. Spock. Life. Okay.
Yeah. Live long and prosper.
Boy, I've just been putting you on the spot here. But is there a song that you, other than, I mean, we did just talk about Abbey Road. Is there anything else where it kind of gets you emotionally?
Yeah, well, I can trace back my analytical interest in the Beatles to a time when I was living in Boston. I remember specifically riding on the Blue Line train up to Revere Beach, just north of Boston, listening to I Am the Walrus. And you know, I was familiar with the Beatles before then. I had heard their stuff. But it was on that particular listen that it just dawned on me, like how profound their music really is. You know, how it goes way beyond just standard pop songs, and there's so much more depth to it. And so that piqued my, it piqued my intellectual curiosity because it first piqued my emotional curiosity, and then from there I've really the last 5 or 6 years really established a career as a Beatles guy,
and really being able to really look deep,
right, and look at how and why the music works.
And in terms of looking deep, in addition to your recent book, The Beatles and the Avant-Garde, which was recently published, and we've been talking about that, I might just mention here a little bit of a plug. You also have two other books out now.
Yes.
The Beatles, Band of the 60s, and From the Shadow of JFK, The Rise of Beatlemania in America.
Yep.
In your book, Band of the 60s, you discuss Bob Dylan's influence on John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of the hour here talking about different people's influence, whether it's Yoko Ono or George Martin or whoever. What was Bob Dylan's influence on them?
Yeah, so we talked earlier about their you know, maturation process,
right,
and how
right.
they started as very youth-oriented, and then eventually, like Help, you know, so much younger than today, eventually they decide to grow up and do something a little more adult than I Want to Hold Your Hand. And Dylan is perhaps the single biggest influence on that aspect. So looking at tunes from like 1965, around the time that the Beatles were hugely into Dylan, you get tunes like I'm a Loser, John Lennon's song, I'm a Loser. And he says something like, although I laugh and act like a clown beneath this mask, I'm wearing a frown. And so for the first time, he's really admitting that what the public sees, his public image, is not who he is underneath. Whereas in the earlier stuff, it's all about that public image, that happy-go-lucky, you know, very poppy kind of style. And then when he starts listening to Bob Dylan with his rather more philosophical and socially aware lyrics, like Blowin' in the Wind, you see that marked shift in the character of Lennon's own lyrics.
When did McCartney make that shift? Did Dylan have as much of an impact on him for that shift, or was it Lennon kind of influencing Paul?
Yeah, it's Dylan's influence on Lennon is seen most clearly in the lyrics, but with Paul, it's more clearly seen in the music itself. Because Dylan as a folk musician was much more acoustic and gentle, as opposed to the early Beatles, which were very rock inspired, which I like electric guitars and heavy drums. In fact, it reminds me of a joke I heard once. How many folk musicians does it take to screw in a light bulb? Five. One to do the work, and four to complain that it's electric. Point is, folk music is distinctly acoustic. Is a distinctly acoustic genre, and so around when Paul in late 64 and into 65, when Paul McCartney starts listening to Bob Dylan with his more acoustic, gentler sounds, he decides, you know what, I want to do that too. I've had enough of the aggressive rock and roll, you know, Little Richard style stuff. I want to try something that's a little bit more folksy, and you get tunes like I've Just Seen a Face, which is a bluegrass inspired folk tune, and quite a few others, Yesterday included, tunes like that. So Dylan's influence on Lennon mostly can be seen in his lyrics. Dylan's influence on Paul mostly seen in the music itself, the acoustic music itself.
Aaron, I don't know if I can listen to a folk song again without thinking about your joke.
Without thinking about light bulbs.
I'm talking to Beatles scholar Aaron Ketovich. You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. And more about the Beatles and lots of other stuff. Don't go away.
Thank you.
You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich. I'm talking to Beatles scholar and historian Aaron Ketovich. In the background, you hear the wonderful Beatles song, The End, from their album Abbey Road, which we found out happens to be Aaron's favorite album, and we spent a little time talking about The End in the last segment. Want to mention, Aaron will be presenting a program entitled The Influence of American Rock and Roll on the Beatles tonight at the Fremont Public Library in Mundelein at 7 p.m. And if you miss it tonight, again, at the Aspen Public Library in Vernon Hills on Tuesday, June 16th. Tell you what, can you give a little preview of what you'll be discussing?
Sure, yeah. It's comparing the recording artists who influenced the Beatles from the 1950s. So the Beatles, of course, are associated with the 60s. So this is looking at artists from the decade prior and how that set up what the Beatles were able to achieve in the subsequent decade. So it's looking at guys like Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, and how their songs anticipated the Beatles' success.
How fun.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites that I do.
One little song that you'll talk about with some of these past guys, One Guy, One Song?
One Guy, One Song. The first one that comes to mind is Little Richard's Long Tall Sally, because that was a concert opener that the Beatles would often use as a way to grab hold, because it's such a fast rock and roll song, and it really does grab attention. So it's an obvious choice for the Beatles to open their concerts, and they would often, not always, but often open their sets with Long Tall Sally.
Well, I don't want to take the wind out of your sails. That's tonight. So, and also on, like I said, that June 16th, if you miss it, again, The Influence of American Rock and Roll on the Beatles. And sounds really, really interesting. Speaking of upcoming events, you're going to be traveling to England next month.
Yep.
To present your Beatles research.
Yes.
A lot of the stuff we've been talking about today.
Yes.
In London and Liverpool.
Yes.
How'd that come about?
Sure. Yeah, there was a call for papers, actually, at an academic conference that's being held in downtown Liverpool next month. And so I said I submitted an abstract dealing with John F. Kennedy and the Beatles and how Kennedy's presidency, life and death helped Beatlemania flourish when they came, you know, 3 months after his assassination. And so I was accepted to present at this academic conference, and I thought, well, as long as I'm there, why not try and do some of the programs that I've done so many times here in the States and try and do them in England as well? So I was able to book four more of them in addition to the academic conference, two in Liverpool, two in London. So a total of five. I'll be there 10 days, and I've got five programs that I'm doing there.
Well, how fun for you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I tell you what, speaking of Liverpool.
Yeah.
So one last question here before you go.
One last one, the end.
And I've been asking a lot of questions.
Yeah.
But if you had a chance to talk to Paul McCartney, maybe the way you and I were talking today.
Yep.
Okay. What's one question you'd like to ask Sir Paul?
Yeah. Well, my current project, I just released the book last Friday, is essentially a full book version of what I'm presenting in Liverpool, and looking at how Kennedy's presidency set up the Beatles' success. So if I could ask Paul one question, it would be, how conscious were the Beatles that they were coming over shortly after such a, you know, this national tragedy? How conscious consciously were you, how conscious was the band that they were coming over at that particular time, and how much were they aware of Kennedy's death and its effect on American culture, and how conscious were the Beatles that they were coming as a sort of antidote to that?
It was a matter of just, what, 2 months, wasn't it? From November to they came over
November
in February.
To February.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're talking, what, 3 or 4 months?
Wow.
Not very much time.
Yeah. Well, maybe someday you'll get a chance to ask him that question. I certainly have had a chance to ask you a lot of questions today,
yes.
And thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And if you wish to contact Aaron or read his daily blog or check for upcoming events, visit his website, also purchase his books as well. Lots there going on. Have it up here on my screen right now. You can go to www.aaronketovich, and let me spell that for you, Aaron, and it's K-R-E-R-O-W-I-C-Z, www.aaronketovich.com. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when I talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.